Coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
Is there a common denominator, biologic transformational change that is associated with integration, with really being able, as a result of a psychedelic experience and the psychotherapy that comes with it, to change? And does that look somehow biologically different? I think this could revolutionize psychiatry, even if no psychedelics are taken, because that's really critical information, because we have been looking for healing in terms of the reversal of biologic changes, or let's call that pathophysiology. You know, if you think about the biology of a mental disorder, similar to breaking your arm, we're looking to see if the arm is mended, right? But maybe it isn't like that. Maybe you're always going to have a broken arm, but the mending involves being able to overlay like this permanent invisible cast. The bone will remain broken, but somehow you're able to work around it and still have a kind of functioning that isn't reversal per se, but it's building something new. So that's why it's so exciting.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I am your host, Eamon Armstrong. Today's guest is a legend in the field of traumatic stress studies. Dr. Rachel Yehuda has been researching stress and PTSD for 30 years, and now, with the promising results from MDMA clinical trials, she and her team have founded the Mount Sinai Psychedelic Psychotherapy and Trauma Research Center. On the show, we discuss the four pillars of Mount Sinai's new center. We go deep into the history of the PTSD diagnosis and the evolving understanding of how trauma works in the brain, including an explanation of epigenetics. We look at how the center will study psychedelic medicine, from basic science using stem cells to specific types of therapy and collaboration with other medical centers. Dr. Yehuda is the director of the Center for Psychedelic Psychotherapy and Trauma Research at Mount Sinai. She's the vice chair for Veterans Affairs for the Department of Psychiatry, director of the Traumatic Stress Studies Division, director of the Yehuda Lab, and a professor of psychiatry and neuroscience at the Icahn School of Medicine. She is also the director of mental health at the James J. Peters VA Medical Center. She has authored more than 450 published papers, chapters, and books in the field of trauma and resilience, focusing on topics such as PTSD prevention and treatment, molecular biomarkers of stress, vulnerability, and resilience, and intergenerational effects of trauma and PTSD. This technically rich and inspiring conversation will be extremely important for anyone working with psychedelics to heal trauma and PTSD. I hope you enjoy. Dr. Rachel Yehuda, welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. It's such an honor to have you on the show. I've admired your work for a long time, and I know that our listeners are going to get a lot out of what you have to share. And I know there's a ton of interest about what's going on at Mount Sinai. So, such a pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me to talk to you.
Let's just dive right in. What is the Center for Psychedelic Psychotherapy and Trauma Research?
Our center is going to really tackle four things, I would say, all focused in the area of psychedelics, psychotherapy, and trauma and PTSD. So we're going to really restrict ourselves to that. The first thing we're going to do is clinical trials. We're just going to study the efficacy of compounds for PTSD, and not just PTSD, but other trauma-related conditions. And also, hopefully, intergenerational trauma and racial trauma. I think it's really important to be able to segue from PTSD into trauma, because so many people have trauma and don't know how to really deal with it, even if they don't have a lot of symptoms or full-blown PTSD. So we're going to do clinical trials. The second thing we're going to do is we're going to do neuroscience research. And we are going to try to do biologic studies before and after psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. We're interested not so much on the question of what happens to your brain as you're taking a psychedelic, but more the long-term effects. What is the biology of integration? Why are the effects of taking a psychedelic sustained? And we have a lot of thoughts on how to do that. Of course, we're also going to be interested in some neuroimaging studies, molecular studies, and also bench work with cell lines that I can tell you about if you'd like. The third thing we're going to do is we're going to try to reach out to other medical centers that are establishing psychedelic research centers, and a whole bunch are cropping up. And this is because I think that we can accomplish so much together if other medical centers, other psychedelic centers are talking to one another and perhaps really thinking about the salient questions, how people can work together, how can divide and conquer, how we can maybe do clinical trials with biology in different conditions or in the context of multi-center trials. Now, the fourth thing we're going to do, very excited about, is that we're going to embark on therapist training. And we're very interested in doing this, not only for therapists that are full-fledged trauma specialists already, but also interested in developing curricula for medical students in psychiatry rotations, in psychology internships. So we're going to create electives, we're going to create postdoctoral experiences and fellowships so that we can really think about the best way to start bringing this material into medical schools now in preparation for a time, perhaps 5 years in the future, where this will be an available option. It is very, very important that as we train our best and brightest, that we also train them in how to use psychedelics in the context of psychotherapy. So those are the four things that our centers might be doing.
Rachel, that is an extraordinary offering, and I can't wait to dive into all four of these points. To start with, can you tell me a little bit about what PTSD is? I know you've worked in this field for 30 years, and the PTSD diagnosis is itself a fairly recent development. Can you tell me a little bit about PTSD and your own work in the field?
Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD for short, is a condition that can occur following exposure to extreme trauma. It is a relatively recent diagnosis. It came out in 1980. Depression and anxiety and schizophrenia, those disorders have been around for much longer than that. And it really came about to recognize the long-term impacts of trauma. One of the mysterious aspects of PTSD is that it only occurs in some people who experience trauma. And so we can talk more about what that is if you'd like. But it's been one of the difficult issues because a lot of people wonder if they have trauma but not have PTSD, should they seek treatment? Is there something that they need to resolve or do? But that is what PTSD is. People with PTSD have intrusive memories of traumatic experiences that have happened to them. Often they have nightmares. They get very distressed at triggers or reminders of the event. They're avoidant. They don't want to think about the trauma or go to places that remind them of the trauma. They be very aroused in their bodies. They can't sleep or concentrate. They're hypervigilant. And they also experience changes in the way that they think about things and in their mood. So it could be very impactful for somebody to have PTSD. And a lot of times the PTSD is actually disabling and prevents people from either working or being present in relationships or really feeling like they belong in society. So it's actually a more common problem than you might think. It's estimated that about 10% of people will develop PTSD at some time in their lives.
And so how did you get started in the field?
Yeah, I was a graduate student in neuroscience. I was studying basic mechanisms of stress. Actually, I was studying the impact of stress hormones on brain development and how the brain functions. So I was doing this work in laboratory animals. It was very exciting brain work, but I knew very early on in my graduate school career that animal work wasn't for me. I really wanted to be able to apply concepts about how stress affects the brain and the mind to people who are experiencing stress and trauma. And so I landed a postdoc after I graduated with my PhD at Yale Medical School in the Department of Psychiatry, where the earliest studies of post-traumatic stress disorder were being conducted. I didn't know what post-traumatic stress disorder was then. It was 1987, but I figure stress, I can do that. And then, yeah, then I came into contact with people that had PTSD, Vietnam veterans, and it was very, very compelling to talk to them and learn from them. One of the problems in doing animal research is that the animals don't really talk to you, and you really have to infer a lot about what's going on from their biologic measures and their behaviors. But here, you could ask people questions, they could tell you things. We did the first biologic studies that were really studies of stress hormones and found some really interesting and somewhat paradoxical things about people that had post-traumatic stress disorder. And the initial findings actually showed that some stress hormones, like the stress hormone cortisol, were actually lower in people with PTSD, these combat veterans. To me, that seemed like one of those medical mysteries that needed to be solved. Why would stress hormone levels be lower in a stress disorder? Some stress hormones like adrenaline were higher. So it wasn't just that there's not a real disorder. I mean, there clearly was. So I basically continued my career trying to explore that, generalizing to other populations, studying Holocaust survivors, studying interpersonal violence, children and adolescents. So that's what I've been doing, trying to chase an early finding and then really realizing that the biology of PTSD is one of the body changing to accommodate a new reality.
Mm. Yeah, tell me more about that.
Yeah, trauma exposure is really a shock to the system, exactly what it sounds like. But what happens to people when they're exposed to an extremely traumatic event is that there's this short-term acute reaction that they go through, the fight or flight response, which everybody knows about, is pretty universal and is actually relatively short-lived. But then there's this other response that is a longer-term response that has to do with how you think about the experience, how you think about what it means to have had what just happened to you happen. And that over time, I came to understand that the biology of this, let's call it integration, of really thinking about what the experience means, is a little separate from the biology of what happens to you in real time, which is more universal. When you start to think about how people process an event, that's where you get into a lot of individual differences because people are so different. And that's why PTSD doesn't occur in everyone who's exposed to trauma, because we can have highly individualized responses in the long run and chronically because we're different going into trauma. We may feel differently about how to interpret what is happening. And so that has its own biology, and that's associated with processes of adaptation and resilience and vulnerability, and it's all very real. And so one of the benefits of having done this research, not just my research, but the field collectively doing research in this area, is to really put a biologic correlate to something that people have understood, which is that the effects of trauma last a long time, in contrast to stress theory, which will have you believe that your body accommodates pretty quickly to the effects of stress, and that people can be quite different in the way that their long-term reactions are expressed. But there are biologic changes, there are brain changes, and there are molecular changes, and those things are real.
So prior to the PTSD diagnosis, people didn't believe that there were long-term biological changes as a result of trauma?
Prior to PTSD, people thought about something called transient situational disturbance, emphasizing transient.
So it wouldn't be chronic for life. It would just
away.
Kind of come and go away.
Yeah, you'll get over it is what it means, right? You'll get over it. And that is what everybody thought about stress. And so here comes this diagnosis that is saying, actually, that's not true. I'm not over it, right? And not only do I have what almost feels like a continuation of the stress response, but an even bolder statement, I'm no longer the person that I used to be. I'm totally different as a result of this experience. So it took certainly me, I think also the field, a long time to understand that we're not really interested in the biology of the short-term response to stress, because that's not the biology that is necessarily sustaining the stress response, and certainly may not be the biology that is responsible for this really dramatic assertion that I'm not the person that I used to be. And if you talk to people that have been sexually assaulted, they'll say, you know, I left that rape victim right there in the elevator where it happened. And I got up, I'm not that person. That person's dead. I've heard combat veterans say this to me. The person that went to battle is not the person that came out of the battle. And that person is never going to come back. First, it took the field a long time to kind of wrap its head around just that concept, that we're not defining the effects of an ongoing stressor. Yes, of course, it's stressful to have any kind of mental challenge. It's stressful to have symptoms. It's stressful to not be able to sleep and to wake up from nightmares or to be triggered by the environment. But you're not being triggered by the environment because you're under chronic stress. You're under chronic stress because you're being triggered by the environment. And the question is, why would you continue to be triggered by something that's in the past? Science couldn't answer that. I went to graduate school and studied the biology of stress for 6 years, the neurochemistry of stress for 6 years. And the idea that a stress response would last longer than a few minutes wasn't a concept. So this idea that something happens, the war is over, you're home safe now. What's the problem? Before PTSD, people were classified according to what had happened to them. There was a syndrome called battered wife syndrome, concentration camp syndrome,
shell shock,
railway spine syndrome. So in other words, people could describe syndromes that they attributed to a specific thing that happened. And what the diagnosis of PTSD did was create a big umbrella term for it all. They focused on the similarities between people that had, let's say, been in concentration camp or been in combat or been subject to interpersonal violence or even accidents or burn victims. They focused on how these people were alike and created a syndrome and asserted that the syndrome results from the trauma. The problem was stress theory, which says that when the trauma's gone, you should adapt. You should no longer show the initial fight or flight. So it was a real kind of mystery to solve. It was a real question to try to figure out why somebody still had symptoms. Now, when I first started doing this research in the 1980s, we didn't have the ability to look at the kind of things that we can look at now. Molecular neuroscience was at its infancy. We spent the first, 10 years of my career at least, looking at stress hormones, things that we can measure like that. There wasn't an ability to look at brain cells, certainly not living brain cells, as there is now. Neuroimaging came to light in the 1990s, really. But then again, you know, what are you studying exactly when you're looking at brain imaging? Well, for PTSD, the kind of paradigms that were developed were that people would examine the brain chemistry that was occurring when somebody was recounting a trauma. Mm. And what they realized was that people were exquisitely sensitive in their brain to traumatic material if they had PTSD, which actually makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, as new tools became available to look at gene expression markers and epigenetics and even genetics, people started really looking at those things and understanding that, you know what, there are enduring effects of trauma, and that the application of epigenetics to the question of why the effects of trauma endure, I think, has been a really pivotal development in the field.
Can you define epigenetics for me, just for if our listeners aren't familiar, because I think that this is a really key aspect to the enduring quality of trauma.
Epigenetics is simply the study of gene expression, of how gene expression is regulated. An epigenetic mark is a molecule that can sit on top of the DNA or in the DNA environment that can change the way that the gene functions. And as people started to understand that genes, that what regulates the expression of genes is not only the DNA that you're born with, gene expression isn't just recreating a recipe from your genetic material, but that the things that happen to you can also create epigenetic changes that can affect the way your genes function, all of a sudden there was a very really ready and available explanation for the question of how an event that happened in the past could continue to influence the way you function. Because an epigenetic change on the DNA that is induced by the environment can create an enduring change in the way the gene functions. Epigenetic marks can survive cell division in the body, so that as your cells are constantly dividing, those epigenetic changes that may result from stress may remain. So this gives us at least an opportunity to think about what enduring effects look like from a molecular perspective. And this really freed us from the tyranny of really the stress theory, which was you're going to adapt within a very short period of time. So once molecular neuroscience opened up this gigantic landscape to be able to understand how environmental events can really have enduring effects, how they can really change the way the body functions or the way that people think for a long period of time, that's when I think people started to really believe that PTSD was a real thing, that had a real underlying biologic basis. There was still the problem of heterogeneity. Why don't we all have the same kind of responses? Does it matter when in development you're exposed, right? Will there be different changes in a younger developing person than in somebody who is an adult? Does it matter what happens to you? And I would say that the answer to all those questions is yes, of course, all of these things matter. And that whereas we like in science and in general to focus on how things are similar, sometimes we learn more by examining individual differences, how we're part. So a very big emphasis of mine has always been trying to ask the question of whether people who are exposed to trauma really do look the same as people who have been exposed to interpersonal violence. And invariably, the answer is yes in some ways, no in others. And so it's just really important to be able to document that. Now, against that backdrop, here is an emerging field of psychedelic medicine, and the first indication through the FDA that has received the most attention is in a disorder that I've been interested in for 30 years. So it's not something that I can ignore. Plus which, I haven't been so thrilled with the outcomes of conventional therapies like cognitive behavioral approaches and antidepressants because although those can provide some symptom relief, generally the effects are temporary, or generally the effects are not that great in people with really complex conditions. So of course, I'm going to be intrigued. One of the things that really threw me off about the findings from the MDMA trials was how many people actually got better. This is brand new. And I had previously in my mind decided that the limited therapeutic efficacy of other treatments are due to the fact that PTSD is just a really heterogeneous syndrome, that there's so many different kinds of PTSD and so many different ways to get PTSD, that every treatment might do something depending on the kind of PTSD you have. But in a clinical trial, you're not going to likely be able to break the code and figure out how to get good outcomes. And most clinical trials will enroll you not based on the trauma you've had, but based on the diagnosis that you carry. So in classic clinical trials of PTSD, they'll enroll men and women, people that are traumatized early in life or late in life, people that have had interpersonal violence or combat trauma. So you introduce a lot of variation just by the people that are in the trial. So then when you don't have this uniform gigantic effect, you know, you can say, well, maybe this treatment only works under some conditions or in some kind of subset that we have to figure out. And our biologic studies were aimed at trying to figure out those subsets and trying to see if we could predict them in advance and also kind of describe how people would look following therapy, and then doing this with a bunch of therapies so that we could ask the question of whether the kind of biologic change you have happens because of the type of therapy you had or just because you're feeling better. Very, very different question. And here are psychedelics that are making more than half of the people not have PTSD. That kind of threw off the logic a bit, but also provided a fantastic opportunity to understand healing processes and even raised the question that maybe healing isn't about how you start to begin with. It's about recruiting a whole separate set of neurobiologic changes that have nothing to do with the biology of the trauma or the PTSD. So just as you can have a transformational experience from a trauma that has this short-term impact that's universal, but then this long-term impact that might vary, what if psychedelics are like that? What if there's like this uniform short-term, this is your brain on drugs biology, which would be parallel to the fight or flight response. But what if then there's this other parallel process of epigenetic transformation that is associated with healing, as opposed to really being stuck in a narrative of suffering about the fact that you have been traumatized. And so I think ironically, the biologic mechanisms that are involved in sustaining traumatic experiences might be very similar, the processes, but not the pathways that might sustain recovery and healing. And I think that's why the application of psychedelics for trauma and PTSD initially has been so successful and will continue to be. You know, there are a lot of people out there that are traumatized. They don't have symptoms. So this would be amazing to find out whether for people that take psychedelics because they would like to process a traumatic event, even if they're not suffering with PTSD, does that recruit the same kind of epigenetic or biologic change? I mean, they're starting differently. So with all these fantastic scientific questions, and we started the center because we're so poised to answer them.
I am so excited to get the answers to these questions. I mean, for me personally, and also coming from the psychedelic community and seeing these transformations out of ayahuasca ceremonies, out of proper healing containers, we're seeing these transformations. So to be able to understand the biology for this is huge. So how is this new center going to go about studying this?
So we're going to do basically a few things. We're going to have clinical trials, number one. So we're going to offer clinical trials in PTSD to start out with. Our first trial is going to be restricted to combat veterans simply because I love the strategy of minimizing heterogeneity, of trying to keep things as uniform as possible to give us a chance to describe something uniform and then apply it to other populations as well, which we plan to do. And through Mount Sinai, you know, we can examine multiple kinds of populations, either at the same time in one study or separately in different studies. We're going to take an approach of looking at a comprehensive set of biologic variables before and after each treatment, and not just at the treatment endpoint, but also look at sustained effects over the long term. What does it look like 3 months or 6 months after somebody has successfully completed a treatment trial? This is the exact same strategy that we have done for cognitive behavioral therapy, for medication therapy. So we're just going to be adding this other layer of psychedelics to see whether healing itself looks a certain way, no matter how it is accomplished, or whether there are different ways that healing looks depending on how you accomplish it. I mean, that's a really good question. We don't have a clue about what the answer to that is. So is resilience a thing that you can get to through many different pathways? Or do you recruit a certain kind of resilience based on a certain way that you achieve resilience? So we're going to look at MDMA. We hope to look at psilocybin. We're particularly interested in the compounds that the FDA is already interested in and trying to provide information about how they work. But then we want to ask another question, which is, what if you don't actually have PTSD? Because this, let's face it, is really kind of a core tension in our field, right? In a medical environment, it's very noble and appropriate to want to study treatments for illnesses. But in the psychedelic movement, people without necessarily having diagnosable illnesses are reporting that psychedelics have really helped them. The reality is that people are looking at psychedelics not only to treat conditions or psychiatric disorders or categories that are in the DSM-5 in psychiatry, they're looking to understand why these experiences are so transformative for them. And most people who take psychedelics do process events from their past and start to see them differently, whether they have lived consciously or on the surface, understanding that these were traumatic experiences or little micro traumas that really meant a lot at the time, but that are buried, we don't know. But a very important question to ask is whether the same biologic networks of healing and resilience are recruited, as in people that might have very serious conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder or depression. So one model is that there's a biology of PTSD, there's a biology of depression. So healing from those disorders involves reversing those biologies. But one model is those biologies are descriptors. They're not signs of something broken. They're just signs of something happening, right? And you just need to make space for them. And what you really have to do is kind of work around them, kind of like models of visual system plasticity. If you take an animal very, very early in life and you sew its one eye shut, you know, can they develop networks around what you've closed so that they can make networks around it and still be able to see? And the question is, yes, if they're young enough. So again, this idea of plasticity is a very important idea in psychedelics. What does that actually mean and what does that look like? And what's so exciting about these concepts is that they really herald a very new paradigm in the way that we look at and treat psychiatric disorders, because we've really been laboring under the assumption that if we can only locate the right biologic target for what's wrong in these psychiatric disorders, now that we have all these biologic tools, and make drugs to reverse those biologic changes, then we can affect healing. But the psychedelic model offers perhaps a different view, which is, you know what? It doesn't matter where you start from. We can recruit networks of healing and resilience. And that's probably why the changes are so enduring. And people do report that when they have a psychedelic experience, particularly one with the intention of healing, a therapeutic experience, I've heard it so many times, it changed my life. And you know what? That's what trauma survivors say. That experience changed my life. But in the first example, it changed my life. It was great. And in the other, it changed my life. My life is ruined. But the same words, it changed my life. So it changed my life must be underpinned by a similar kind of biology. And that's what we're chasing in our studies. So it's not necessarily the this is your brain on drugs, that the pharmacology, which I think is important. I mean, understanding the stress response has been a really important thing to do. And understanding the pharmacologic effects of psychedelics and how they might differ. How are the short-term effects of MDMA different than psilocybin or different than DMT or different than any of these other compounds? I mean, that's important information. But a deeper question is really, is there a common denominator biologic transformational change that is associated with integration, with really being able, as a result of a psychedelic experience and the psychotherapy that comes with it, to change? And does that look somehow biologically different? I think this could revolutionize psychiatry, even if no psychedelics are taken, because that's really critical information, because we have been looking for healing in terms of the reversal of biologic changes, or let's call that pathophysiology. We've been looking to see whether, you know, if you think about the biology of a mental disorder similar to breaking your arm, we're looking to see if the arm is mended, right? But maybe it isn't like that. Maybe you're always going to have a broken arm, but the mending involves being able to overlay like this permanent invisible cast. The bone will remain broken, but somehow you're able to work around it and still have a kind of functioning that isn't reversal per se, but it's building something new. So that's why it's so exciting.
So the trials are with PTSD and MDMA. We also have experiments with psilocybin. We also have ketamine for treatment-resistant depression. If we're talking about a certain biological mechanism that creates healing across psychedelics, does it matter which molecule we're using? How are you planning to study the efficacy of the different molecules?
So that's a really great question. And I think that, you know, until very recently, the way that you study the effects of a different compound is you have the same person take different compounds and you study whether they have different effects. But we have developed some biomarkers that involve stimulating live cells. And so this is what we call an in vitro or in the test tube kind of an experiment. So for example, we can take blood cells and culture them into live lymphocytes, and the lymphocytes will behave very similarly to how they would behave in your body, but now they're in our test tube. And what we can do is we can stimulate those lymphocytes, let's say with stress hormones. And when we do that, we see that the lymphocytes of people with PTSD react very, very differently in terms of gene expression patterns than the lymphocytes of similarly exposed trauma survivors, in this case, combat veterans, that don't have PTSD. And we just published that in Translational Psychiatry in 2019. So this is a biomarker, meaning you get a set of gene expression pathways that clearly distinguish one group from another. Well, you can make this a lot more interesting because you can start putting into the cell culture all these different kind of drugs and really compare the impact of each and every compound on these gene expression pathways But one step even better than that, since we don't really think that PTSD is a blood disorder, right? One of the things that we've developed in my laboratory is that we take skin cells from patients with PTSD and similarly exposed trauma survivors without PTSD, and we take their fibroblasts, so skin cells, and we grow them, and we take those fibroblasts and we reprogram them into induced pluripotent stem cells. So what happens is you can take up a skin cell and convert it back into a stem cell. And a stem cell is an embryonic cell before it differentiated, before it got the epigenetic instruction to differentiate into the cell that it's going to be. And then you can reprogram those stem cells to become neurons. So you can actually have in a petri dish neurons of somebody with and without PTSD and be able to stimulate those neurons either with, we've been stimulating them with stress hormones, but what we can also do is take those neurons and incubate them with many different kinds of compounds, many different kinds of psychedelics. We can compare them to antidepressants. We can look at a lot of different things and ask a very simple an answerable question, which is, do these different compounds induce different gene expression pathways? And we're asking it in living neurons from the same donor. That's a much easier way to understand, at least pharmacologically, what the effects are of different compounds on the same individual. And then when you consider the idea that different people might have different gene expression pathways, even if they both have PTSD, you can begin to kind of arrive at a very personalized approach, assuming you can make this portable and scalable, to understanding how somebody might respond to different kinds of compounds. Now, I don't think that we're going to be using this in the future on patients, but it's very interesting proof of concept work so that we can really understand, you know, just what are the differences? How dramatic are they? Or more importantly, what are the commonalities? Or we can understand whether psychedelics are really having effects as a group that are very different from more traditional antidepressants or central nervous system drugs. So these are the kinds of things that you can now do in science. And at a center like the Mount Sinai Center, we can bring all of that technology and all of those neuroscience developments to bear and do this kind of bench laboratory work. It's not in animals, it's in people. We can also do very sophisticated brain imaging. You can use computational neuroscience approaches to really look at kind of genome-wide epigenetics and gene expression studies and relate them with brain changes that you see before and after taking specific psychedelics. So there's a lot for the field to do. So
this begs the question, what about the therapy component of psychedelic-assisted therapy? So you're talking about studying these different compounds and how they're affecting, on a molecular level, the neurons. How will Mount Sinai study the efficacy of the therapy component of psychedelic-assisted therapy, and perhaps study the differences between the activity of the drug itself versus the therapy and what therapies would be effective with it? Is that something that you'll also be studying?
There are so many questions to ask about this. One of the things that is being stressed in the field right now is that taking a psychedelic without the opportunity of integration may not be as helpful as having a psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. And certainly for MDMA and certainly for PTSD, the therapy is a very, very important part of the experience of taking the psychedelic. There are very interesting and important ways that you can unpack that experience. You can really compare people that have just taken a psychedelic with people that have taken the psychedelic and had the psychotherapy, for example. If you want to just look at pharmacologic effects, you can kind of subtract out the pharmacologic mechanism of action effects from those that you observe in somebody that has really completed a full course of therapy, complete with integration. There are a lot of questions to ask also about the therapists, whether, you know, classically with the MDMA trials, they're using two therapists. Is that really necessary? And do the therapists themselves have to have firsthand knowledge of psychedelics or not? And there's some really important questions about whether it matters what kind of therapists they are, what kind of patients there are. And I think that, you know, these are all things that can be examined in the context of an academic center. And one really important question has to do with patients of color and whether it's better for them when they're treated by therapists of color, whether it matters, whether any of these things matter. And so, again, the way to know that is to ask and answer it in the context of research and scientific data. It can take a long time that way. A lot of people want to rely on anecdotal experience, which is fine, but to really be able to really trust fall into effect, you have to create it through the scientific method. At least that is what I think.
And so do you think that it's important for the patient to understand the basic science that is going on in the psychedelic experience?
That's a really great question. A lot of people say that I don't really care how a treatment works. I just care that it works. And on a human and clinical level, you know, I totally understand that. And they're right. You know, I don't have to understand how my computer works. I just want it to work, right? I just want to get on the internet. I don't need a whole lecture on how the internet works. You don't have to understand it, but somebody does, right? If we want to understand more broadly how psychedelics work, what is the nature of healing and resilience? I mean, in the future and in the present, people are thinking about what compounds they can manufacture, why one compound might be better than another. What is the basic science that's supporting, that's providing the scaffolding for even being able to evaluate whether something is better than another, other than the trial and error of clinical trials? So by exploiting molecular neuroscience and all of the things that it can do, perhaps we can take a better, more rigorous scientific approach towards understanding why one compound might be better than another, or one approach might be better than another, or whether we should take a personalized approach towards helping somebody decide what kind of psychedelic they should take, or more importantly, they shouldn't take. So, you know, you can get drugs FDA approved without the science, right? And you can certainly have a wonderful experience or not on a psychedelic without knowing the science. But ultimately, the field has to understand why this is a breakthrough. The field has to understand whether making people better is about recruiting new pathways or reversing biologic changes that might be contributing to symptom expression. That's a really important thing to do. And someone's got to do it, I think, so that this can have real sustainability.
So in psychedelic circles, we talk a lot about set and setting. And in the indigenous shamanic traditions, it seems that they have tested this set and setting over time. Is this something that the center will be studying?
Well, so that brings up a really important question about really the context and whether these psychedelic experiences are working because of the active medicinal ingredient or because of the context. And it's a very simple question to apply the work we're doing to understand the biology of integration. That is, what do you look like 3 months later after you've had three experimental sessions and 12 sessions of psychotherapy and have had the chance to really integrate, whether the experience is important? Somebody can do the very same kind of study using a more shamanistic experience or anything like that, because we talk a lot about set and setting, but now we have to study how relevant set and setting are to the healing process via, for example, differences in gene expression or differences in brain circuitry. I mean, these are really important questions. Because we can, on the one hand, say set and setting, and it's not the compound, and then only do studies about the compound. That's a mismatch. That's going to create an irrelevant science. To have a relevant science, we have to be able to go into exploring the biology of things that are hard to study, like the set, like the setting. And, you know, John Hopkins, they've done some excellent work because they have really tried to study things like mystical and spiritual experiences, which makes the average academic a little queasy. But it's very important to be able to define the things that require a biologic counterpart and require an explanation. If we really want to send the message that psychedelics are safe when used in a specific context, we have to study the biology of the specific context. And we have to prove it. Because when we studied MDMA and other psychedelics just in the context of substance abuse and recreational use, that produced a literature of serotonin neurotoxicity and a really scary literature that helped sustain the category of Schedule I classification. So if we really want to reassure the world that there is a safe and therapeutic way to take these drugs, then scientists have to be able to show what that means, to try to study what that means and demonstrate, or at least ask the question of whether there are different biologic processes recruited under different conditions above and beyond the drug itself. And that's what we really want to do. That's the holy grail to me, because again, healing is more than just the neurochemistry of the particular compound. That's kind of the cul-de-sac that we're in now, thinking that we can understand both the pathophysiology of psychiatric illness and its treatment by understanding how a specific compound works on a specific network or a series of networks, without understanding the greater context of the ingredients that contribute to healing when it is combined with a medicine.
I love that answer. I love the search for the holy grail of combining the medicine and the context and the therapist. So in addition to the collaboration of context and therapist and molecule, there's also the collaboration of these different medical centers. The third pillar of Mount Sinai's new center is really about collaboration. So can you tell me a little bit about how you are approaching that?
No one center is going to be able to study every compound. So as other academic institutions are opening up centers, and as also investors are very interested in examining compounds and doing research and development on them, we're going to have a big landscape of clinical trials. We're not going to be able to do all of those clinical trials, but having this kind of basic science work might be very informative to people. You know, this creates an approach and a pipeline as new drugs become developed for, you know, kind of comparing it to other drugs that are already there. The beauty of doing work with stem cells is that they're always there. You can keep developing them, right? There's something magical about a cell line. And so if the scientific community gets organized, there's an extraordinary amount of information that is possible if we kind of ask really good questions together as a field. And again, you know, one of the four bullet points that we have in our center is really to develop a real consortium among academic medical centers so that we can do this kind of team science. There have been a lot of advances in genetics and genomics because people have come together to share samples, and that requires collaboration and commitment and sharing. So I think that that's a really important thing to do. The science is such that most people will think about very similar questions to answer, right? But the strength becomes in a really coordinated approach, you know, really having this be a symphony and not just a bunch of soloists singing their songs, but the power of the symphony, the power of really doing work that builds on work that someone else is doing and really creates a powerful set of knowledge. Because, you know, we had the chance with psychedelics in the 60s and 70s when everybody was falling in love with them, and that got snatched away mostly because I think people were very misinformed, it turns out in retrospect, about some of the detrimental effects of psychedelics or what the true risk profiles for these compounds were. The more information that we have in the scientific community, the more we're able to really use psychedelic and any medicine more wisely and develop a personalized approach. I mean, they've done this for cancer. I mean, most people who are diagnosed with cancer don't just get a random chemotherapy. A lot of work is done to kind of understand the molecular biology of the tumor and of the individual and really do a lot of thinking about what the appropriate chemotherapy would be like. And there's really no reason not to take chronic psychiatric illnesses that seriously. They're not life or death in the same way as cancer. But for somebody that's been struggling for a really long time, understanding that there can be a science that might be brought to bear for some of these questions. A lot of people feel that they are guinea pigs. They've been to so many doctors who have tried so many different things on them. Could there have been an approach that would really minimize the number of treatments that you're offered based on a certain objective profile? The way it is now is you'll get the kind of treatment you'll get based on what the doctor likes to do, right? If you go to an EMDR specialist, you'll get EMDR. There's nothing wrong with that per se, but what if there was a better vision, right? What if there's a better way to take this seriously? You know, so far with psychedelics, it looks like a lot of people get healed. Well, you know what? If that's really true, we have to be all over that scientifically and understand what that's about. And so that's an opportunity in this space also. So that's the third thing that our center is going to do, the first being clinical trials, the second being scientific mechanisms of action, the third being trying to work with other medical centers.
So in addition to your collaboration with other medical centers, what's your perspective on the field right now generally on the development of drugs, investments, and the position of a scientific perspective like yours within it?
So I think that the status of the field right now is that there are a lot of people very eager to make investments and very eager to develop new compounds, but there has to really be an investment in the science, an investment in the kind of thing that usually gets funded by the National Institute of Health or funding organizations that really lay a foundation in biologic science that then drug developers often exploit. I mean that in the positive sense, right? Because you want to build a drug based on a lot of basic science or clinical science that already exists. So as we're going into this new world of developing compounds, testing compounds, thinking about how to maybe even combine compounds, we have to lay a foundation. You don't have a building without a foundation, and science is the foundation. So it's hard to really convince an investor that if you contribute to basic science, in 5 years, there may be a better product down the road because you will have developed a scientific pipeline in which to investigate the compound. But I think that that's really the work that has to be done. I do think that funding organizations will be interested in the basic science that is needed. But until now, the kind of science that got funded in the psychedelic space was the science that helped support the Schedule I classification. The science that helped tell the story of why psychedelics aren't good for you. And we just need a countervailing science that tells a different story. And so if you think about the 20 years of funding from the National Institute of Drug Abuse and what that's created, we have to have a different kind of science now that asks this question in a much more agnostic and neutral way and without an agenda. And I mean also without an agenda for psychedelics are the greatest things since sliced bread. Agnosticism in science is really important. And being neutral when you ask questions and look at data is really the only way to ensure that you're going to get something valuable. So again, that requires a lot of discipline because we all have ideas about what we think going into asking a question. But the real, you know, just like the real discipline of clinical work is to try to stay neutral and curious about a patient without superimposing your own material inside. It's the same thing with science. We have to stay neutral and curious without imposing our particular orientations and or experiences. I had a cousin who died in a rave, you know. We have to keep all of that out, and we have to just develop a science that is objective and asks the right questions and is designed in a way to address the true questions and not just the ones that are easy to answer.
So with that in mind, do you have a message for the broader psychedelic renaissance and movement?
The neutrality and the discipline that good science requires, I think it's not something that is fully appreciated. I think a lot of what I'm seeing in the psychedelic space has to do with advocacy. It has to do with people that already feel that psychedelics are wonderful, figuring out how to get them legalized, get them more accepted, or market them more broadly, or something like that. What our center is really going to focus on is just testing a lot of these assertions. Because we're in mainstream medical environment, I can tell you that this fantastic enthusiasm that is shared by people that are in the psychedelic renaissance is not necessarily shared by people who are not in the psychedelic renaissance, but it's those people that really also need to be spoken to, and the language that they will listen to is objective science, data-driven research. So it's really, really important not to leave people out of the conversation, especially if we really want these therapeutic tools to be embraced and used to their fullest potential.
Well, Rachel, we're almost out of time today, but I wanted to spend just a moment on the fourth pillar of the new Center for Psychedelic Psychotherapy and Trauma Research.
The fourth one's really important and near and dear to my heart, and that is training therapists. And also training the next generation of medical student and psychology students. The benefit of being at a medical school is really understanding that you have that ability to kind of influence curricula, to offer electives, to offer people opportunities to learn in school while they're still in school, how to work with these compounds. So that's a tremendous benefit because there's really something wrong with going through medical school or going through graduate school and being taught how to treat PTSD and depression without even mention of psychedelic psychotherapy, trying those treatments on your patients, not succeeding as much as you want, and then only later in life saying, well, you know what, I better go for some advanced training in psychedelic psychotherapy. What if we integrated it early, right? What if we introduced it now as a viable option along with all the other options that we introduce? Psychedelics may be contraindicated or may not be warranted, but the reason shouldn't be because the therapist doesn't know how to use them or is afraid to use them.
Well, and that brings us to our specific audience of the show, which are the psychedelic therapists themselves. People who might have worked with MAPS clinical trials, people who might be integration coaches, people who are very interested in this field. And I always like to, at the end of every episode, offer my guest a chance to speak directly to the healers and aspiring healers who are or will be working with these molecules. So, Rachel, what would you like to say to those folks listening?
Well, to many of you, thank you for teaching me and thank you for inspiring me. At this point, I have a lot more to learn from the psychedelic community than I have to teach it. And what I'm really hoping is that I can be an honest broker and take the information and the wisdom that so many people have and really bring it into the mainstream, subject it to really critical scientific testing, and really keep the integrity of the process that has been developed sometimes over very long traditions, sacred rituals, even underground. But there is a very rich history that is sometimes a difficult conversation for an academic who is really bound by legalities and rules and really has no option whatsoever or discretion but to follow those rules. But the information that is out there, I know, is rich and impactful and meaningful. And I want to hear all of it and learn all about it and really extend my very strong desire for collaboration with all communities that are interested in psychedelics.
Thank you so much, Rachel. And thank you for coming on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. How can our listeners connect with you, connect with the new Mount Sinai Center for Psychedelic Psychotherapy and Trauma Research? How can people get connected?
We have a website for the Psychedelic Center, ICANN/Mount Sinai Psychedelics. There are a lot of ways. I love getting emails. I love hearing from people. We're going to be posting a lot on social media, trying to keep people informed about what we're doing. And we do appreciate the feedback. Again, the opportunity of an academic medical center is to study something rigorously. But how does it know what to study? It has to hear from people who are in the field and really generating knowledge and questions and experience. So we want to hear all of it.
Well, that's a wonderful invitation, Rachel. Thank you. And thanks again for coming on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.